This morning in the first hour of the show, we have back as our guest Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist with the U of I and has been here on the program many times before to help with insect pest problems in the home, around the yard. If you've got something that's in the house that's causing you trouble, if you have something that's in the home landscape, attacking ornamentals or things that you want to eat, any and all of that is certainly fine. If you want to call in, tell us what it is, and I know Phil will do his best to see if he can help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 33-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thanks for being here once again.
Glad to be here.
One insect that is in the news, and I want to make sure that we talk about, I know you're prepared, is the emerald ash borer, which is a threat to the ash tree. And we have now seen, we have identified them in a particular place in the state of Illinois. And one of the things you said before we got going here is that now the people have heard that the insect is around and they have ash trees they're worried about, maybe some people are going overboard in treating where they don't need to be.
Yeah, it's been identified in Kane County, which is in the northeastern part of Illinois, far western suburbs of Chicago area, essentially more directly between Lily Lake and St. Charles in that area. And we've identified a number of trees. There's been the Illinois Department of Ag has identified, at last I know, 19 trees that are infested. Originally, there were seven that were found. The thing that they're formulating methods and so on and doing surveying at this point to look at trying to control this. This is a beetle which will tunnel into the tree, and it acts a lot like bronze birch borer, except it attacks and kills healthy ash trees. Comes out of holes that are D-shaped and about an eighth of an inch across, starts at the top, the tree starts to die from the top down. The insect, it will probably eventually eliminate ash in North America. It's that severe. Mm-hmm. How severe does elimination of the ash? Well, in the Chicago metropolitan area, which has more than most areas of the state, they have estimated that 20% of all the trees in the Chicago metropolitan area are ash trees. So that's what they have a chance to lose. We get down into Champaign-Urbana, we're probably looking at 10%, 8%, somewhere around in there. Guidelines are more down around 10%, but when you have poor soils, poorly drained soils, things of that nature, ashes do well, and so they've been overplanted in the Chicago area. The important thing is that this insect is going to migrate and move maybe a half a mile, at the most 5 miles a year. And so we get people that are kind of going overboard as far as, I need to protect my tree, and they're 300 miles away from the insect. I mean, that's really not in line with what should be done. We tend to fall in line with what Ohio State and Michigan State recommend, and that is that if you have a tree that's within 10 to 20 miles within the same county as trees that are and as an infestation, then preventative treatment should be in line. But if you're remote away from that, there's no reason to pay for treatment of a tree for a pest that is not very likely to show up. I mean, when you start thinking, well, can it possibly? Well, yeah, you could have brought in firewood a couple, 3 years ago, and you may have it already in a tree, but that's a relatively unlikely scenario for most people. And so it's a case of where we say, you know, don't go overboard, don't start treating your ash trees. Believe me, you'll get tired of paying for it well before the ash borer gets here, and you will have spent several hundred dollars over several years for no real good reason, and you've put pesticides unnecessarily into the landscape. Mm. So that's kind of what I wanted to get across.
Well, given the two things that you said, on the one hand that it moves slowly, but on the other hand that some people are projecting that eventually there won't be any ash trees anymore, what's the timeline?
I would say that probably within 200 years there won't be any ash trees in Illinois, maybe not North America. Mm. So we're talking about a fairly long timeline. What we really need to be doing in preparation for the emerald ash borer is, when we're looking to put a new tree in a landscape, ash should not be at the top of the list. That doesn't mean it's not on the list, but we need to get the number of ash trees down to 5%, maybe 3%, somewhere in there. So when eventually the emerald ash borer, in all actual probability, will come through the area and take all the ash trees, it won't make a devastating impact on the landscape. And ash trees are going to survive in somebody's yard. It's hard to say how long. The University of Illinois tends to look at about a 35-year lifespan for trees before that trees would live that much longer than that. But before that, in that length of time, usually you're going to have to lay some underground cable. It's going to take out the root system. You're going to put a new sidewalk. It's going to take out the root system. You're going to do something that's going to essentially destroy that tree in within about 35 years. So, and that's probably maybe 50 or 60 years might be in a typical residential landscape before something like that happens, or 40 years or something like that. So the point is that we probably have a time over the next few decades to drop the number of ash down. But on the other hand, there's still a good tree, and there's probably some places where ashes should still be planted, but not you tend to think of other trees first.
Yeah. Let me ask you one other question, because the thing that struck me when I remembered hearing these stories now a couple of weeks back was that the people who were studying it felt that those borers, those insects, had actually been there for a while.
Yes.
So that, in my mind, that raises the question, could they be other places and they've been there for a while and we just have not identified them yet?
Chances are good that way. In this situation, the borers have been there probably 4 to 5 years. In the initial infestation in the Detroit, Michigan area, they had probably been there for 6 or 8 years, maybe 10 years. Before they got onto it, and the area was there's a lot of spread that went on. I feel that probably the insect is in the tree for at least a year, probably 2 years, before it really becomes noticeable, and it may be even longer. I was up at the site in Kane County about 10 days ago and saw the situation, and there happens to be an ash tree right across the street from the original tree, it was reported. And it looks good. You look up to it. It looks good. Looks fine. Everything's healthy looking, nice shape. The people have taken care of it a lot. They've had regular fertilizations and kept it watered and things of this nature. However, when you sit underneath a tree and you look up to it 10, 12 feet up in the branches, you can see the telltale holes. And there are literally hundreds of borers in that tree. Mm-hmm. Yet the tree is showing no damage yet. And that's the sort of thing that makes this insect hard to detect and hard to pick up. So you're right. They can have some damage. They can be in an area for a while before you really get onto it and realize what's happening. And there's so many other things that can cause an ash tree to look poorly. There's several different things that they get that will cause them to even have holes in the side of it, in the trunk, but not the same type of holes. So it's a kind of a difficult thing pest to get your hands on.
Okay. Phil Nixon, our guest. If you have questions on insect pests, you can give us a call. The lines, however, are full right at the moment. So if you do call, you're going to get a busy signal. You can give us some time to work through the callers that we already have. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll start with White Heath, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'll be the first to say it. Japanese beetles.
Well, we knew somebody would.
I figured I might as well be the first one. Here's a question about them. I have this, I think it's called a mock crab tree or something like that, and they have attacked that. And now, is that going to damage the tree because of lack of nutrition, and, you know, from the leaves and all that stuff?
The damage from Japanese beetle on ornamental trees and shrubs is primarily aesthetic, or hurting their looks.
Okay.
They like the sun. They will start at the top of a tree and feed on those leaves first. It's very common in this part of the state, or any part of the state, as a matter of fact, to have to lose the upper quarter to third of the leaves. They will turn brown. They will look somewhat unsightly. They eventually fall off. But the important thing to realize is that what many people don't realize is that a tree and or shrub, particularly trees, do most of the sugar production, food production for that plant in the first part of the year when those leaves are still flexible and soft and so on. And so we have a lot more impact on a tree from an insect that feeds in the spring, like gypsy moth, because it's dropping the energy from a tree. By the time we get about halfway through the growing season, which I like to kind of put at July 1, we've pretty well, the tree has probably gained the vast majority of the food it's going to get from those leaves in a year. Now, it will get more later in that year, but comparatively, it's a relatively small amount. I'm not sure how much, 20% or something like this. It's not very much compared to what you get in the first half, which comes down to the bottom line is it really doesn't hurt to help that tree to lose its leaves after July 1, okay. particularly some of them. Thing we get most concerned about is losing a lot of leaves. Then the tree decides that it's going to put new leaves on too late to gather enough food to make up for the energy it costs putting on the second set of leaves. But generally with Japanese beetle, this late in the year, by the time you get real heavy feeding, you're getting into the end of July, the trees normally are not going to re-leaf significantly, so it's probably not a big health effect, which is why we recommend that if you're going to treat for Japanese beetles, don't necessarily treat every tree in the landscape that has a problem. Treat those that are going to be the most aesthetic problems to you, such as the tree next to the front door or something of this nature. The rose bush you really love next to the back door.
Yeah, yeah.
But the one out there that primarily keeps you from seeing the garbage can real clearly, that may not be one that you need to treat.
Okay. And one other bug I've got is this huge wasp. It must be an inch and a half. And they've never bit, but they just act aggressive. But they do eat the Japanese beetle. I don't know which is worse. So I don't know what kind of a wasp.
Well, the most common wasp that would fit that scenario to a certain extent would be cicada killers, which are going to be about an inch and a half long, yellow banded, reddish wings. The females will tunnel into the ground, and they primarily attack cicadas. They will go after other large insects. And they can sting, but you pretty well. I've known of three people got stung by them in my career. Two of them grabbed a hold of them barehanded, and one stepped on one barefoot.
Okay.
So you got to go out of your way to get stung by one of these.
I'll just sort of brush them away then.
Yeah, but ones that are intimidating are ones that are the males. They will hover in front of your face and zip around to the side and back and so on.
Uh-huh.
And these don't have the stinging equipment. Stingers on bees and wasps are modified egg-laying devices, and they just don't come equipped. So they are. What they do is they form aerial territories, and as anything comes into their territory, they check you out. They figure you're either a female which needs to be mated, a female cicada killer, or a male cicada killer which needs to be driven off. Or if you're none of those, after I figure out that you're not one of those two, I'm going to ignore you. They check you out when they come in and zip around you and bug you, and then maybe and then they disappear, and maybe about 50 feet across the lawn or 100 feet, you enter another cicada killer's domain, and he does the same thing all over again to you. So that's where you get the intimidation factor.
Together in this one section of my house in the dirt, where there's dirt, so they can make holes. So
okay.
I'll try to convince my grandchildren they're harmless.
it's a great opportunity to do a little bit of education about nature and how everything that looks bad isn't necessarily bad.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for the call. And we'll go on to line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about indoor pets and cedar wood. I believe, all my life I've heard about cedar chests.
Uh-huh.
And I have been seeing in catalogs and in stores these rolls of cedar, very thin cedar that they recommend for lining, in cabinetry and
closets, et cetera.
And closets, right. What is it about cedar that makes it so useful, if it really is useful? And what do you think about these advertisements for cedar spray, whether that works?
The cedar has an aromatic oil in it that's effective in repelling and in high enough concentrations killing insects. But for it to be effective, it really needs to have close proximity and high amounts to the insect themselves. In a cedar chest, I always make the comment that if you can walk by the cedar chest and smell it, it's not working. It needs to have a seal on the lid such that you have an airtight seal that allows the cedar fumes to build up to where if you were inside that cedar chest, you'd be coughing and your eyes would be running from the fumes. That's the level that will help to control the insects. Similarly, a cedar-lined closet, which is a very expensive thing, but has the door standing open on it, just as well not have any cedar in it. It needs to have that, those fumes build up highly, and it should be a door which is kept shut and sealed. Cedar bedding materials for pets and so on would have some effect in that the flea larvae will tend to get down into the debris in the bed and things of this nature, feed on debris from the adult fleas, fecal matter. And when they're right in close proximity to the cedar chips like that, that might have an effect. Cedar sprays probably will have a fairly good effect of killing something on contact, but as having a residual life that would last for a period of days or weeks afterwards, only if it was in an airtight situation would that be likely to be a factor.
So these things like cedar balls and hanging cedar things?
All are good things as long as they're in airtight situations. If they're not in airtight situations, you just as well have your clothes smell better than that.
Okay. So cedar spray is useful for spraying, say, the bottom of a dresser drawer?
If you have something there that you're trying to kill on contact, yes. But on the bottom of a dresser drawer, assuming that there's going to, in that situation, there would be some air movement out from that area, probably has almost no effect long term. It would kill an insect that you might hit with a spray in all likelihood, but it's probably not going to last and protect for more than an hour or so.
Okay. And these rolls of thin cedar that they recommend that you line your dresser drawers with, that doesn't work either.
If you have an airtight dresser, that would be effective, but I've never seen an airtight dresser yet in my life.
Okay. Well, thank you. This has been very informative.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks for the call. So if, for example, there are some manufacturers who make storage boxes that are intended to store clothes, things that are like Tupperware.
Right.
Like that, if you could actually get an airtight seal,
right,
you might get some benefit.
You could store clothes in a, say, a plastic garbage bag or a garment bag that is similarly airtight and put cedar shavings in that bag, and that would be effective. You could have a hall closet that you take for the summertime. You take all the wool suits and things that are not going to be worn all summer, and you put them in there, and you have a gasket on the door such that when you push it shut and close it, it seals top, bottom, all the way around the threshold. There, if you have cedar in it, it will be effective. But otherwise, all you do is maybe emotionally, mentally, you get this feeling, well, I smell cedar, I must be doing something good. You know, you got to be. It's got to be pretty intense to do anything against the bugs. Yeah.
Anything else that you could do short of that? Other sorts of things that are supposed to keep. I guess particularly the concern would be clothes moths,
carpet beetles. They do. Particularly, clothes moths can only survive on soiled wool. So dry cleaning woolen items before they put away for storage for the summer is a great idea. That will give pretty much 100% protection. However, most of our damage comes from carpet beetles that will attack and survive on clean wool. And even so, if it's clean, it's less likely to be attacked. And if you can provide airtight storage for it during that time, even without cedar shavings or moth crystals, that will provide good protection as well. Because if it's airtight, then the beetles on the outside, which are attracted to flowers around your house and lights at night, so they'll come into the house. If they can't sense the wool on the other side of a plastic bag or other airtight storage, they have no reason to try to get in. And a plastic bag they could easily chew through. But if they can't smell anything on the other side, why should they bother? And they don't.
All right. Phil Nixon's here. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I. And every once in a while he's here. We talk about dealing with insect pests around the home. If you have a problem, you can give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go over to Belgium. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. Mm-hmm. I hope I don't dominate too much of your time here for a second. First off, cedar, there's a specific type of cedar you're talking about. And the specific type of cedar you're talking about is what's called Eastern Red Aromatic Cedar, grown mainly in Tennessee, southern Kentucky, northern Alabama, Georgia. That's the
And every place around here that you don't mow it off.
Oh, well, it really won't survive the winters very well.
It's the same species.
It's the same species, but they don't get large enough to.
But you're right. It's different from the northern white cedar that they make your pencil out of.
Oh, and it's also different from the western red cedar.
Right, or western red cedar is what they make your pencil out of, right?
Yeah, they also use western red to make siding and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Think of siding. So you have to know which cedar you're getting.
But generally, when you get cedar siding for the purpose of, or cedar paneling for lining closets or cedar other things for protection, it's going to be the correct cedar in general.
Yeah, it should be. But I mean, if you go to somebody that's building a cedar chest for you, make sure they use a proper cedar.
Yeah.
To step back to your emerald ash borer.
Huh?
I've been speaking with you folks for a few years about it because I noticed it happening several years back, and I started talking about it. And we probably ought to point out one other thing about the emerald ash borer. It's specific to a particular type of tree, which is the ash tree, which is also in the family of the olive tree. And it may have effect on some other trees besides just the emerald ash because it does feed on other trees in Asia and areas like that where it's originally from.
But it has been very heavily tested against these other trees that are found in the United States and found that it does not survive.
Oh, yes.
It will live for just a few days, make a tunnel which may be about a half an inch long in close related plants such as lilac and privet, and which are in the same family, the olive family, along with Fraxinus or the native ash species.
Yeah.
But it does not survive. It does not able to live. That was one of the first things they did research on in Michigan when they found this insect, was so they knew the host range of this insect.
So there's none of the other...
Yeah, it's been found to feed in a juglan species, which is our butternut and black walnut in this country, but in a juglan species in the Orient. And it has been very much tested against our juglan species and found it does not survive.
Well, there must be a slight difference.
Well, that or also it could be that the you got to realize that this is not a this is an insect which comes into trees that are already declining and about on the brink of dying anyway in China and Korea and other areas where it is naturally found. It is not a tree. It's not an insect which kills healthy trees over there, and so as a result, the research has been very limited on this insect, so it could easily be that some of these host records from the Orient are ones in which the insect may have been misidentified or something of this nature. It's hard to say because it's not a prime pest over there. It's something that we would not even bother to work on much in this country in those types of insects.
I see. Now to go on with this, does it take a certain level of maturity for the tree? Because I've noticed it doesn't seem to affect the very young...
We've seen it take out trees that have as small as a 1.5-inch diameter trunk, which is pretty darn young.
It goes very
small. I saw a whole row taken out that had only 2.5 to 3-inch diameter trunks in the western burbs of Michigan three years ago.
Is that right?
So yeah, probably 150 trees planted along a boulevard.
So it will attack the small trees too, huh?
Yes, it will.
So we're not going to be able to step over. It seems like when a Dutch elm's disease.
Yeah, Dutch elm is something that just hits your bigger trees. And to this day, American elm is one of the most prevalent trees in our forests of Illinois. It is not prevalent in the size of the trees or how big the trees are, but as far as number of trees, it is very, very high, like 2 or 3 in number of trees that are out there, because Dutch elm doesn't kill the tree until the tree gets old enough to reproduce. So you have a huge number of young elm trees that are still out there, and as they grow up, they get Dutch elm disease and die, but they've already reproduced before that occurs.
So that in effect, we could possibly, once it kills all the ash trees, if we could keep some ash trees separate, the bugs will die out, and we could repopulate with ash again.
That is a theory. But the problem that comes about it is there'll be some people, I would assume, that will want to pay all that they can to keep their beloved ash tree alive, which will have a few ash borers in it, which will make it so that if you try to plant a new ash tree, it'll find it. So, you know, theoretically, if you were in a dictatorial state where you couldn't allow anybody to keep their ash trees and spray them, they would come in, kill all the ash trees, wait 2, 3, 5 years, come back, plant new ash trees, there's no bugs, they've died out. Yeah, exactly right.
That would work.
But in a capitalistic society, that doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist with the U of I. Every once in a while he's here. We talk about dealing with insect pests around home, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to Urbana next, and this would be line number three. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Again, back on the emerald ash borer.
Mm-hmm.
Again, could you please repeat the timeline before it's due to make its presence here in Urbana?
If it moves on its own, I would anticipate that, we're looking at about 130 miles, half a mile a year. Theoretically, it would be a quarter of a millennium, but 250 years. However, chances are excellent, almost overwhelmingly so, that before that happens, it would be moved in here most likely on firewood by somebody accidentally. And although there are going to be restrictions on firewood movement, the chances of that happening are almost overwhelming if you look at the number of people who live in Champaign-Urbana, the number of years, the number of trips, from campgrounds, someplace else where they pick up some wood out of Aunt Joyce's backyard or whatever the case may be. Sooner or later, it would show up. So I would anticipate that it would be here within 50 years or so. But it could be here now, and we don't know about it. It's that's the uncertainty that's there. But if it was moving on its own, it would take probably well over 100 years to get here.
Okay. Lastly, too, for those of us that do burn wood, are the two cautions then no firewood from Indiana and, in general, no ashwood?
In general, the USDA Animal Plant Health Inspection Services and the U.S. Forest Service is trying to use this insect as a springboard to try to restrict the use of firewood that is found, which is collected more than 50 miles from where it is used. Because there is, you can go on websites and you can find a whole litany of insects, huge lists of various insects that are found in various parts of the world that are real threats to eliminate live trees in this country, and they're going to move primarily on firewood. They're borers, and if we can just stop moving firewood all across and around this country, we can greatly reduce any impact of any of those insects that might get into our country in the future. So it's a situation. Unfortunately, we have cases where, they ran across a case in Wisconsin, and you know how many trees they have in Wisconsin, where firewood was being sold there that originated in California, for goodness sakes. So, we got to stop that sort of thing. And so what the campaign is use firewood that comes within 50 miles of your house, and you're probably going to be fine.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. All right, let's go to Farina, Illinois. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I have two concerns. The first is the Japanese beetles.
Uh-huh.
They smothered my alceas, and they're dead this year, pretty much. And I've heard of using neem oil, and I've heard of using tobacco on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm worried about them going to my vegetables because they seem to be jumping species this year in my garden. They're on things that they didn't get on last year, it seems like. And then my second thing was about this mosquito spray that they keep spraying in town. And what do they use, do you know, and what that might be doing to my garden, because my garden's right in my yard. And we keep finding lightning bugs. You see the light, and then you go to it. It's laying on the ground because it's dying because they just sprayed. And we're wondering if it's going to be killing butterflies and pollinators.
Okay, what you've got here is the Japanese beetles are, to my knowledge, I can't really think of any major vegetable plants that they feed upon.
Uh-huh.
It's primarily trees and shrubs, and so I don't think you're very likely to have that. They feed heavily on Rose of Sharon, which you mentioned, and can do a lot of feeding damage there. It's if a plant died, it was most likely due to something else rather than just Japanese beetle. Well, the Japanese beetle may have weakened it somewhat,
yeah,
and made it a little more prone to that. But I think that we've got a host list of Japanese beetles that I think it runs around 150 different species. So there are a lot of things it feeds on, but there are a lot of things it doesn't. You're not going to find Japanese beetle feeding on a needled evergreen, for instance. And that's just one example. There are many things that they don't feed on. It just seems like they're feeding on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't worry about them getting onto your onto your vegetables.
Good.
As far as the mosquito spraying that's done, they're going to be using a pyrethroid of some sort. Resmethrin is one of the more common ones. I don't know exactly what they're using there. Important thing to realize is that there is a the amount that they normally apply is about one-fifth the rate that they would normally apply to spray if you're going to use the same insecticide to spray insects on your trees or shrubs or wherever. So it's a much reduced rate, which an interesting feature, reason they can do that is because mosquitoes, adults, are easily killed on relatively low amounts of insecticide, and that's all they're looking to do is a knockdown effect. One other interesting feature that you have with pyrethroids, which resmethrin is one of, is that many times they will knock an insect out, and if the insect has obtained just a very small amount, many of those insects will recover. Not all of them, but many of them will, and particularly at a reduced rate, your fireflies or lightning bugs could be that direction. What I'm trying to say is they're using a lower rate and is really going to have a major effect on beneficial insects such as the fireflies or the butterflies or anything like that, but they could be some effect, particularly if it happens to be very close to the truck as it goes by. So you do need to be watchful as far as harvesting out of your garden after this has happened to wait a period of time, preferably a couple, 3 days. And anyway, you need to look really at what the waiting period would be. And again, a lot of that has to do with how close the vegetable garden is to where the spray is being applied, so you get an idea how much is getting hit with it.
Does it wash off?
Yes, it will wash off.
Thanks.
What about the other pollinators?
What about the other pollinators?
Other pollinators fall in the same category as the butterflies and the fireflies and so on. There could be some effect, but in the overall scheme of things, the amount that they're applying is a low enough rate that it's not going to have a major direct effect. Okay?
Okay. If we think they're overspraying, do we have any rights? Because it seems like they sprayed extra 2 days in a row.
You can contact your city government. They will put you in the right place. And in general, I'm not sure about the Champaign-Urbana area, but the general rule of thumb is that there are, if you wish to have them not spray next to your house, they will respect those wishes.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. We have another other caller. So I want to ask a question here. Most of the time we're talking about getting rid of insects, but we have a question here from somebody who asked their question off the air who is interested in dragonflies and would actually like to attract dragonflies to their yard and wanted to know, is there anything that they could do that would do that?
Put in a water garden.
So you need to have some water.
Yeah,
small pond or something.
The immature stage of dragonflies are aquatic predators, and my wife and I, we're running somewhere around 12 outdoor ponds for fish and various other things, and we have lots of dragonflies, and when we pull in, say in these areas and net out the fish, we come up with large numbers of immature dragonflies. So generally, that's one factor, is if you've got the place for the larvae to live in, the nymphs, the immatures, that will give you a good source of adult dragonflies. The other thing is the adult dragonflies are going to feed on small winged insects, particularly mosquitoes and midges and things of this nature. And many of these have aquatic larvae as well. So they all tend to come together to a certain extent. In general, the more diverse your habitat is in your home landscape, the better off you are. If you have one of these backyard habitats like the National Wildlife Federation or other organizations tend to promote, you're going to have more wildlife of various types, more different kinds of insects, more types of prey for dragonflies, the more likely they are to be around. I've seen them before. Huge masses of dragonflies, 50, 60 of them, feeding on an emergence of ants in my own yard, winged ants. They were picking off the ants at about 20 feet off the ground, 30 feet off the ground, and about 60 or 70 feet up off the ground, there were the barn swallows getting the ants that the dragonflies missed. So, you know, it was just a layered predation event. So, you know, the more diverse your landscape is, the more of these types of things you'll have.
All right. Let's go on to another caller. Next is Munster, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm calling because I've noticed a few very large black ants that have come inside my house.
If they're at least a quarter of an inch long as wingless ants, they would be carpenter ants.
Okay, and what do I do about them?
Okay, carpenter ants are going to hollow out wood to live in. They don't eat the wood, and so the amount of damage to the wood is relatively slight, a couple feet along a 2x4, something of that magnitude. As a result, carpenter ants in a house that's lived in and maintained are not going to cause a house to fall down, roof sag, anything like that, unless they just happen to be in the wrong place. Very unlikely for that to happen. The main problem is the nuisance factor. The ants, if you're seeing just a couple free a day, are probably coming from an outside nest, and you need to make sure that, that tree limbs are not coming within 3 feet of a house roof, you can even use an insecticide spray around the foundation to help keep them out. And you'll find that in your local home centers. It's a pyrethrin material, typically.
Is it okay for pets, though?
Yes. Once it's dry, it should be fine. Some of the, particularly for dogs, the same material is used for flea control. So same, not the same container, but the same basic insecticide. It has other things with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have seen, say, a dozen or more a day, that's indicative of a nest inside the house, and it will be probably in an area that had some water damage in the wood in the last 5 years. If you lived in your house the last 5 years and you can think back to, well, we had a roof leak there or a water drain pipe leak there, chances are there or below it, because water runs downhill, is where the nest would be. And it will be a hollow area, and there'll be coarse sawdust out from an opening that they would be using. And you can replace that wood or soak the nest with an aerosol ant and roach spray and kill off a colony.
I see. Okay, I haven't seen that many. So
yeah, it's probably just ones. It's probably just ones wandering in from outside, and you can ignore them if you wish, or just, as we put it, remove them individually as they are seen, which means you jump up and smash the debris out of it, or you can pick it up and throw it outside. Although they likely to bite you. But generally, you don't need to do any spraying if you're just seeing an occasional one.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Going up next to Arlington Heights, Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Just got a question. We use a major pest control company for our home, and it's costing lots of money. And curious if it's worth it. We don't seem to have any problems, and can we just do it on our own by buying stuff at the local hardware store?
The materials that a professional uses are either the same or very similar to what you can buy yourself. What you purchase from a pest control company is knowledge and convenience, and you can do both. You can educate yourself, and you can, if you want to do the labor yourself, you can do it yourself. Typically, treatment is going to be done on an every month basis, and as such, they keep most of the insects out and down to where you don't see them. A lot of it depends on whether you need to continue with a service like that. It has to do with what your personal feeling is about seeing an occasional insect in the house. Generally, you can put up, if you're willing to put up with seeing an occasional insect, remove them individually as seen, as we just talked about with a previous caller.
Right.
You can go for years. I have a house in which both my wife and I are relatively tolerant of the occasional insect. And we've been living there for 20 years and have never sprayed on the inside of our house. So, you know, it just depends on what your level of tolerance is and what you're willing to put up with. It's by no means a given that you're going to have to spray it all inside your house or have a service. But for those people who just get really upset at any insects or something like that, these companies provide a valuable service to them.
Do you recommend a source of reference for what to use for what we don't like? Or
if you contact your local extension service, your extension office, they are able to sell you a book for $25, I think, which is called the Home Yard and Garden Pest Management Guide, and that has all of the University of Illinois Extension recommendations for control of essentially any insect you're going to find in or outside the house, landscape or wherever, trees, shrubs, household, across the kitchen floor, etc. And what we recommend insecticide-wise for control or non-insecticide controls and how to do it.
Very good. Thank
Home,
you
Yard,
very
and
much.
Garden Pest
all
Guide.
Night.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And in most cases, will people be able to identify the insect so that they will? Because I think in the past when you've been here and when Sandy's been here, you know, anytime we talk about this, I think the one of the things you always say is we need to make sure what the problem is
right
before we decide what to do about it. So in most cases, will people
Your most common insects, most people are going to recognize a cockroach, or they can fairly easily by browsing on the internet, ants, things of that nature. The most common things, crickets, they're going to be spiders. They're going to be able to recognize those. They can verify them through some internet browsing pretty easily. And for those things that are not the most terribly common things, your local extension office is going to be helpful in identification. If they can't handle it, it eventually gets to me. So, it's identification is the first step, and our publications are based on the idea that for this particular pest, this is what you do. So certainly you need to identify it right. But for many of the household insects, we have a tendency to have been educated through our life experiences as to what many of the most common things are. And if you run across something that's a little unusual, particularly if it's more than just one or two, then you can find out what it is. You know, one or two of anything can come in through the door. So it's whether you have an abundance of them. And that relates to, as I was talking about, having some sort of some level of at least some tolerance for an occasional insect in your house.
Uh-huh. We have about 10 minutes left here with Phil Nixon. He's extension entomologist with the U of I. We're talking about insect pest problems around the home. Could be inside the house, could be in the yard, in the home landscape, could be something that goes after your ornamental plants, could be something that goes after your garden that you're going to want to eat, any and all of that kind of thing. You have a problem, you can call us and tell us about it. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I believe that next we're going to talk with someone in Indiana, Dana, Indiana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Do one more comment on the emerald ash and
sure.
a question.
Sure.
I recently had a huge ash tree in my front yard, a beautiful old tree, and I was on the lookout for emerald ash. I didn't want him to get it. I was one of those guys that was going to protect it at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
Lightning got it last Friday, so it just totally annihilated it. It, if I counted the rings correctly, it was about 96 years old.
Okay.
And just perfectly healthy.
Uh-huh.
But I was wondering, now that it's hit and it's all turned into firewood, what would the actual bug look like if I found one?
Okay, what you'll find is if you have that insect, underneath the bark you'll see a lot of tracks through on the sapwood just under and on the underside of the bark itself. These tracks will be meandering back and forth across it. That's a good indication. There will be some eighth-inch diameter D-shaped flat on one side holes through the bark where the adult beetles will emerge. The larvae themselves are going to be up to an inch and a half long and white and flat and look like a series of a beaded necklace type thing, very obvious segments that way. And then the adult beetle is a half inch long bullet-shaped emerald green colored beetle.
Okay, then that's where the name comes from.
Right, that's where the name comes from.
Easy to identify if it had been there.
And in Indiana, we know of them being in some northern suburbs of Indianapolis, as well as in northwestern Indiana, up in that area, northeastern Indiana, in the area adjacent to northern Ohio. So that's where we know that they occur in Indiana, and unfortunately, there's enough of them there that there's really not any money to do much in the way of control. So when you go look at replacing your tree, I would suggest that you think other than an ash tree for a replacement.
Other than ash. I thank
you. All right. Thank you. Next line, number 1, this is Chamonix Champagne. Hello.
Line 1?
Yes.
Yes, I have a question regarding spiders. I do painting, and so this is why I have a question.
You painted a lot of spiders in your day, then.
I've seen some in closets and all. So, yeah. Question regarding the brown recluse. Is that something I would come across here in Champaign?
You could come across it in Champaign, but you're very unlikely to doing interior painting.
Okay.
You're going to almost never come across it doing exterior painting because it doesn't survive outdoors in the winter, but it sounds like you're an interior painter.
Interior, yeah.
The thing is the brown recluse is a nocturnal spider and hides in cracks and crevices in the daytime. So the most you're likely to do when you're doing painting inside is you might paint shut a crack it's hiding in and doom it. But other than that, you're not likely to, assuming that the clientele that you have clean out the closet or whatever you have to do before you get there. If you're in the case of having to move out a bunch of boxes and clothes on the floor, things of this nature, a brown recluse could conceivably be hiding in something of that nature. So you just need to be careful where you reach. And that fits in for all of the homeowners listening, is that you just don't stick your hand up underneath things blindly. There is a possibility of a brown recluse bite in that type of situation. They like to hide on the underneath sides. In cases that I've found them, I found them most commonly inside underneath dresser drawers, back underneath boxes, things that aren't really moved much at all, out of the way places. So you're really going to do some sort of serious cleaning to run across one of these. I had one living on campus in my window air conditioner for a period of several weeks or months. Didn't know what it was until it molded and I saw the cast skin hanging in the web.
Is it a big spider?
No, it's probably leg span is usually about an inch to an inch and a half, and it's a very gangly leg spider, relatively long, slender legs.
I call them daddy long legs.
Yeah, those type of spiders, ganglier than I'm talking about. The Fred-legged type spiders, the cellar spiders or Phocids, or the daddy long legs, the harvestmen, those are much more spindly. But this will look like more like a regular spider, but the legs just seem to be very long and slender. And it's brown and has a dark brown violin shape fiddleback on the back with it.
Is the body large?
The body is only about a quarter of an inch long,
okay,
typically, and then the leg span is about an inch, inch and a half.
And then another spider, I have a question that these I'll come across fairly frequently, whether inside or outside. I'll see them, but I think it's called a wolf spider.
Yes, these would be long-legged, fast-moving, kind of hairy-looking spiders. They're going to come in through cracks and crevices. They are not considered to be poisonous to people, but they do scare you because, well, they run down their prey, as their name implies. They hunt like wolves. They run down their prey. They don't use a nest, a webbing, and so they move quickly. And if they're disturbed, before you know it, they're up and gone. So.
Okay, but they're not poisonous.
Not considered to be poisonous to people. No.
To people. Okay. Any other spiders I should be concerned with in the area?
That's pretty well it. We occasionally get a black widow, but those are going to be primarily in outdoor outhouses around state parks and things, and also in rodent burrows. So,
okay,
you know, people will go out and work on woodchucks and stuff like that. They run across them, but
okay,
most normal people don't in this state.
But back to the brown recluse, that is something that's pretty, it's uncommon in this area.
Yes, it would be uncommon for somebody to have it in south, north of Interstate 70. It's a case of somebody brought it in, somebody moved from far or south and happened to be in their materials, or maybe they bought a box of something for almost nothing at a yard sale and some were living in the bottom of a box or something, you know, something of that nature.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And I guess, you know, it's my understanding, too, about the brown recluse people I've heard about this. And while you wouldn't want to be bitten by one, the chances of you dying from being bitten by one, it's not going to.
That's
right. It's not that bad.
In fact, recent research indicates that probably a good number of the brown recluse bites that have been reported in the past by medical officials, physicians, et cetera, have been probably staph infections or something else. I've got a list in my office of about 40 different things that could be misidentified as a brown recluse spider bite. Mm. Now, staph infections are a very serious thing and probably more serious than a brown recluse bite. We have staph varieties that are strains that are resistant to all antibiotics, and you can actually, you've probably known of people who died of staph infections in the hospital. So that's not to say that's not important, and it's not to say that maybe the bite of a brown recluse or other spider allowed a staph or other infection to get in there that could be serious, but it's pretty unlikely. They've done some surveys in Missouri and found out that 70% of all buildings in Missouri probably have brown recluse. As you get farther south, it's much higher. If you want to move to Florida, you have a 90-95% chance, probably higher, of having brown recluse spider in every building you go into in the state of Florida. So, or Georgia, you know, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, you know, the whole essentially south of Interstate 70, the chances of having brown recluse spiders in a building are much greater than not. So it's an exceedingly common spider, and obviously we're not losing everybody in the southern U.S. from these bites.
All right. I'll try to get at least one more caller here. We've got somebody on cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi, I have two really quick questions. The first one is, occasionally we'll find a cockroach walking along the floor, and we just squash it. We only get these like about, they're seasonal, mm-hmm. and we'll only get four or five of them. And but I'm from New York, so cockroaches are sort of strike fear in my heart. And what do I do about that? Do I have to do anything?
Well, chances are if you only see an occasional one, three or four or five a year, very likely what you're seeing are wood roaches, which are coming in from the outside. The adults of the males will be winged and fly to lights at night. An occasional one will get into your basement or something like this from the outside. These are native roaches that need a cold, moist winter in order to survive and moist throughout the season. And they're not really a threat of reproducing in the house, and what you've been doing is just fine.
Okay.
Step on them when you see them.
Great. Second question. 25 years ago when I got the house, we had it chlordane treated while that was still legal for
uh-huh.
termites.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that that was like a lifetime treatment as compared to what they use now. Is that true? Do I have to keep
should be good for it? Should that 25-year-old treatment should be good for at least another 10 years. Research indicates that it lasts for at least 35 years.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask you one last question really fast. A half an inch. It looks sort of like a centipede or an ant, but it seems to have a pincher on the rear.
This would be earwigs. We had a lot of earwigs this year. They're reddish brown, about a half an inch long, have pinchers on the back end. They will come into houses. They like cracks and crevices, but they need large amounts of soil and a cold winter to reproduce, so they're not a threat to reproduce or increase in number in your house. So, again, removing them as you see them indoors is all you need to do.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. And those pinchers there on the back, they're used by earwigs in mating.
Yes.
Uh-huh. They do not bite you with those things.
Well, they will pinch, and I've even had one lady call me up, said she broke the skin on her underarm. But
seriously?
Seriously. I've seen them. I've had them where I just let them bite try to pinch all they want on my fingers, and I can't even feel it. So, people get bent out of shape about these more than they need to.
All right. Well, we're going to finish there. My apologies. We can't take the last caller. But you can call your local extension office, and they can help you out with these sorts of things. And if they can't figure it out,
it eventually gets to me.
All right. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Phil Nixon, he's an extension entomologist here with the University of Illinois, and occasionally he's here on the program where we talk about insect problems.